And tonight we're going to go to Genesis chapter 17. Judges 17, not Genesis. Judges 17. Judges chapter 17. We're going to read verse 6. I think this might have been the verse that, interestingly enough, or the phrase that Ben just underlined when we were downstairs. This phrase occurs twice in Judges. Once here, and then once at the end of the book. But it says in Judges chapter 17 and verse 6, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes," implying that the king was supposed to be one that maintained some sense of order and such. Whether that ever was absolutely true, except perhaps for a little bit under David, I'm not for sure. But we're going to look at two events tonight in the book of Judges. And these are the ones that I kind of thought we would refer to last week as the icky events, but we're going to look at them tonight. And the first one we find in Genesis chapter 7, Judges. I keep saying Genesis, don't I? Judges chapter 17 and verse 1, it says, "There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah." He said, and keep in mind, now Ephraim is the tribe to the north of Benjamin, if you were to look on a map. So there's Judah, Benjamin's a little country, Dan is over here, and which is going to be helpful here. So from your perspective, here's Judah, here's Benjamin, little country of Benjamin. Next to it is a little country of Dan, and then Ephraim up here, just to kind of give you a perspective on where we're at. You could look at it on a map. But he's of the Ephraim. His name's Micah. They're not Levites. But he's going to do something he shouldn't anyway. He said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son, for by the Lord." No, it's by Jehovah. She gives Jehovah credit this. He then returned, which probably when she says that, "Blessed be my son by Jehovah," there's a possibility in that that what she actually is doing, she may be taking the Lord's name in vain. Because to take the Lord's name in vain would be to commit him to a thing that he had not committed himself to. It didn't just mean saying, "Oh God," although that was also vain, but it was a little bit more than that. So verse 3, "He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother and said, 'I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord, to Jehovah, for my son, to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will return them to you.' So then he returned the silver to his mother. His mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image. And they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, a little temple, mini temple, and he made an ephod. Ephod is a garment. The priests wore them, kind of a fine linen garment. And household idols, similar to, in this regard, to what Rachel stole when she left with Jacob, when she left her father's house. And consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. And then it tells us, and in those days, there was no king in Israel. So everybody's doing this right in his own eyes. Okay, in there, if we go back to Genesis or Exodus 20, and we were to walk through the Ten Commandments, what commandments has he violated in those verses there? Not to have any other gods before me. Not to make any graven images. Okay, so he makes a graven, a carved image like this. Okay. On top of that, what other part of the law, not the Ten Commandments, but what other part of the law does he violate?
He had stolen them in the first place.
Okay, he had stolen.
He made one of his sons a priest.
Takes a person that's actually not of a priestly line and makes that person a priest. Precisely. This is what happens. So here we have this problem here up there in Ephraim with people that are already now beginning to worship other gods in this sense. I'll be honest. When you look at this, they actually talk about Jehovah in here, and I think that this is the other. This may be another part of the problem you and I don't get. When they make these graven images, they may be, there's a possibility because of what they say, and they're using the title Jehovah, that they may have been creating these as what they in what they felt were in some way images of Jehovah. Jeroboam did this. When he is afraid that Israel is going to go back to the south, and when they go to Jerusalem and they're going to retreat to the house of David because they have to go to Jerusalem, he says, you don't need to go down to Jerusalem. And so he makes two calves, one in the north and one in the south, and he says, you can come to these are your gods. And where? What other place did we have a calf worship situation? Yeah, when Moses up on the mountain for 40 days, Aaron takes the image, takes the items that these people have, and he melts them down and carves them into a calf. And when he does that, he says, "This Israel is your God. This is what brought you up out from Egypt." And I really believe that what Aaron is trying to indicate is, in some way, let this be Jehovah. And I think that Jeroboam's doing the same thing. But the problem is pretty soon people aren't relating in any way to Jehovah. But God told them back in Exodus, you're not supposed to make a carved image. You're not even supposed to make an image and try to represent me with an image. Because he says, you saw no shape on the mountain. Now, God did appear with some type of a form at one time, but he says, but that's not really how God exists. God does not exist in a shape. Despite what some Pentecostals and Mormons teach, God does not exist in a physical shape. Okay, he's a non-corporeal being. He's spirit. So I'm just trying to say this. I'm not excusing these people in any way. I'm just trying to show you that these people have such a twisted understanding of these things that as they make these idols, I think part of the way you justify it is you say, oh, we're going to worship Jehovah. Now, that shouldn't surprise us because in the history of the church, very long time ago, 1,500 plus years ago, the church began to make carved images that they put up in their basilicas, in their church facilities. And they would put images of the saints, and they would make, they would even make windows. In fact, to this day, a lot of churches have stained glass windows. But a lot of that, all those images and the paintings and everything, it was put into the church because this is what they said. People are supposed to have faith, but faith needs something to see to help it along. Scripture says, we walk by faith, not by sight. That's 2 Corinthians 5:7. Hebrews 11:1 tells us that faith is the thing that makes something concrete or substantive, the evidence or proof for which is not seen. And so here we have this example in the history of the church where they were saying, hey, we can help people's faith by giving them some images to focus upon. So, you know, you make a lot of pictures of the Madonna and Christ, Madonna and the Christ, Madonna and the Christ, all the way down to eventually you have Madonna with the dead Christ draped across her in a garment as she's holding him after his death. I'm not exactly for what chapter and verse that comes out of, because I don't know that she ever had charge of his body in any way. It was a couple of men that actually did. But I just say that they did those things. When the Reformation came along, you had a reaction with the iconoclasts that went around and were breaking all these images. And Luther, who will remember, was not trying to start another church, but was trying to reform or correct the Catholic Church, when these people ran with what he was teaching and started destroying all these images, he goes, no, stop. As long as people aren't bowing down and worshiping those images, they're good, because he still bought into this. Those images can help them in their faith. See? Because it gives them something to see and gives their faith something to focus upon. Which really is a poor understanding of the concept of faith. So I just say those things again, not in any way to excuse these, but I think
some
maybe
people even take it like the Buddha rites, that you can't have any pictures on the wall because that is a graven image.
Because you may end up, you may end up worshiping that item. Precisely. So this is the kind of situation that, you know, they were dealing with. And there is I think that we find ourselves a parallel in the way that things operate today. We don't, particularly in our churches, put up a lot of images. I mean, we have a picture of a cross, but I don't think people get too, in our church, I don't think we've spent too much time being cross-oriented in that way. But we're probably not going to put up, you know, start putting images of the saints up. And we're definitely not going to put a cross with the Christ on it up front. It would ruin the projector's screen. But on a serious note, we're not going to do that because we really don't, not necessarily, I think, because in and of itself it's wrong to have those images in the churches, but because I think they're done for the wrong reason. You don't need to have those images to focus upon, okay? We understand faith a little bit different than that. Okay, so we move on from his initiating this whole matter of worshiping these images and such, and then it says in verse 7, now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. Now this is interesting because it says he was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, which is from the family of Judah, but he was a Levite and was staying there. And I'm not exactly for sure, I'll have to be real honest, I'm not for sure how he was a Levite unless he is a Levite on one side and part of the tribe of Judah on the other side. But this man then departed from the city from Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he might find. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? And he said, I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place. Oh, I do remember the one, I didn't write a note on this, but I do remember some people made the comment about him that he may not him personally have been from the family of Judah. But it says Bethlehem and Judah of the family. So he was the Levite that worked among the family of Judah down there. It's one way of understanding perhaps his background. But Micah tells him in verse 10, dwell with me, be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10, NASB says 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance. And so the Levite went in. And the Levite agreed to live with the man. And the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated, that is, set apart then the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. And Micah said, now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest. So now we have another element in come here. First, the man had, remember, taken his son and made him a priest. Now he actually has a Levite as a priest. But the Levite is doing something he's not supposed to do. The Levites were not, they were not supposed to worship. They were not supposed to, number one, they weren't supposed to encourage the worship of idols or anything like this or graven images. But secondly, they weren't supposed to carry out worship any place except where God had chosen to place his name, which at this time is not yet Jerusalem. The temple is, or the tabernacle is not in Jerusalem. There's several places up in this area where the temple's at Shiloh for a while, or the tabernacle's at Shiloh for a while, and then it gets moved someplace else, and then it's moved in. So it's in a few, several different locations at different times until eventually David, over in 2 Samuel, brings the ark down to Jerusalem. But up until that time, it's not there. But the thing is God had not set his name yet where this person is at. He set it where the tabernacle was set up. That's where it was at. The other thing to keep in mind is, David does bring it down, that God allows him to do that, but what was one of the ways that they knew that the tabernacle was supposed to be where it was at?
Where it was at.
Where it was located.
Was it still a pillar?
There's still a pillar cloud over this. In fact, there ended up being a pillar cloud with regard, even when they built the temple, there was a pillar of cloud that was associated with it during some of its time. And this is one of the things that I missed reading this stuff when I was growing up as a kid. But you catch it now as an adult, and it stands out with a little bit more interest. Maybe it wasn't that cool as a kid. It goes on and it says in verse 1 of chapter 18, and in those days there was no king of Israel. So it kind of repeats what we just had in verse 6. And in those days,
is that a play of words since God, they weren't treating God as master?
Yeah, and see, God was supposed to be the king, and that's actually, remember, we will get there eventually, but when the people ask for a king, Samuel becomes upset, incensed, and he gets upset. God tells Samuel, Samuel, don't worry, they're not rejecting you, they are rejecting me from ruling over them. We've got other statements like that. I think we looked at it, I think it was Gideon. Couple weeks ago that we saw with Gideon, that Gideon said, who am I to reign? God reigns. God is a king. So we have those statements. So it says, and in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in. So this is telling you, so this is one of the things, let's back up and kind of fill in some information for ourselves. The book of Judges is not strictly chronological, that there was this judge, then 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 this judge. We already established that the first week, that we have different judges in different parts of that land that are judging, some of them simultaneously, some of them at different times, obviously. But it concluded with Samson. Now, he's not the last of the judges. The last of the judges is going to be Samuel, but we're not really going to have Samuel come into the picture until we get over to the First Samuel. But the last chapters of Judges, what they're doing for us by talking about every man doing what's right in his own eyes, is it's showing you some of the spiritual state that these people were in during this time of the Judges. We have this thing, it says that these people bowed down and served other idols. It's told us this several times. Well, what we're going to be given here are two stories at the end of this book. And they probably didn't happen after Samson. It's just that it's being told. These are two examples of events that went on during the history, during this time of the Judges. And one of the things that you can understand when you're reading verse 1 is the people of Dan are still looking for their inheritance. So they're still not fully established in the land at this time. So this actually takes us back quite a bit earlier within the history of the Judges. So they're looking for an inheritance to live. To live in, for until that day an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. Well, it had been under Joshua, but see, they haven't taken full possession of it. So it's showing you that this is a little bit earlier. So the sons of Dan sent from their family five men. Verse 3, it says, and when they were near the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young man, the Levite, and they turned aside there. So they apparently had come in contact with this Levite. Perhaps they'd gone to Shiloh, like they were supposed to, if that's where the tabernacle was located, and they'd actually maybe heard this priest, heard this man. And they said to them, well, who brought you here, and what are you doing in this place, and what do you have here? And he said to them, thus and so has Micah done to me, and he has hired me, and I've become his priest. And they said to him, well, inquire of God. So notice this, ask God. See, this is what I'm trying to get across here. It's not that these people have just totally abandoned God. It's like, they're practicing what's called syncretism, where they're trying to mix what they're doing with what's going on around them. And so instead of realizing that God told them in the law that they were not to make carved images, they were not to have idols, they were not to try to represent God in any way, they've done this anyway, they've exercised these things, and they're trying to equate, they're trying to put these things together. Okay. Syncretism is when you try to align what you believe the Bible teaches with what somebody out in the world also thinks, and you try to match the two, try to make them work together. So he tells them in verse, or they say, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be prosperous. And the priest said to them, go in peace. Your way in which you are going has the Lord's, notice that's Jehovah's approval. So the five men departed and came to Laish, saw the people who were in it living in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, for there was no ruler humiliating them for anything in the land. Now when they come to the people of Laish, they're not coming to Israelis. These aren't Israelis. These are people of Laish like the Sidonians. The Sidonians, remember, are descendants of the Greeks. They're up north, up by Tyre, along the seacoast. And so he's talking about non-Jews, non-Israelis. So they're quiet and secure. Go over to verse 8. When they came back to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, Their brothers said to them, "What did you report?" And they said, "Arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And will you sit still? Do not delay to go." And so when you enter, you come to a secure people with a spacious land for God. So they actually are quoting what God said. They're quoting this land and what they were supposed to do and how they were going to take the land in there. So then from the family, verse 11, from the family of the Danites, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, 600 men armed with weapons of war set out. They went out and camped at Kiriath Jearim in Judah, and therefore they called that place Mahadan to this day. Behold, it is west of Kiriath Jearim. They passed from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. And the five men who went to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their kinsmen, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod and household idols and a graven image and a molten image? Now, therefore, consider what you should do." And they turned aside there, and they came to the house of the young man, the Levite, to the house of Micah, and asked him of his welfare. And the 600 men armed with weapons of war, who were of the sons of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the five men who went to spy out the land went up and entered there, and took the graven images and the ephod and the household idols and the molten image, while the priests stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons. So they go and take these things. Probably because as they're waging war, they look at these things as though they're charms. They look at this stuff as though it's gonna make us lucky. What other time in Israel, or no, we haven't got there yet. I'm sorry. I've studied and I've got the notes all written out. But what other event in Israel's history was similar to this, where they treated something else like a charm? They were in battle in the book of 1 Samuel, and they say, "You know what? We're failing against the Philistines. Go get the Ark of the Covenant." And so Eli's sons take the Ark of the Covenant out, and Eli's sons are killed, and the Ark of the Covenant is taken by the Philistines. All of this because these people treat these things as though they're some sort of magical charms that are going to enable them to fight. Okay? What? Yeah. And it's really interesting. People still read it like that. If any of you remember, honestly, what is my favorite movie ever, Peg?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Thank you. My favorite movie ever, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, yeah. But in that, they open this book. I still remember there's a scene when these government agents have come and talked to them. And Indiana Jones opens this book, and he shows this picture of the priests carrying the ark, and these beams of light or lightning shooting out of it. And they were talking about, you know, how if you carried this into war, you know, you were invincible, you know. It just shows you that this whole charm idea is perpetuated right even down to this very day.
If you saw the Shekinah glory coming out of heaven.
Oh,
you can see why they
would think that. Mm-hmm. But is that the way God did it? Did God actually say take the ark into battle and use it as a thing, and I'll bring lightning bolts? That's not the way God had them. God did step in. God did fight many of the battles, but. So it goes on and it says, they take all these things in verse 19, and they said to him, "Be silent, put your hand over your mouth and come with us, and be to us a father and a priest. It is better for you to be a priest to the house of one man, or to be to the priest to a tribe and a family of Israel." Well, he was a priest for all 12 of them before, but he settled for being one man's priest, and now there's a tribe that's asked him. And the priest's heart was glad. So he took the ephod and the household idols and the graven image, and he went among the people. And they turned and departed and put the little ones and the livestock and the valuables out front. The whole problem, what this is that these people begin to practice this. And I want you to look in verse 30. Well, let's go back up to verse 29. And they called the name of the city Dan. They conquered the city. Of the name Dan, their father, who was born in Israel. However, the name of the city formerly had been Laish. And then verse 30, and the sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, there's this Levite, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. Do you notice that? the writer of Judges tells you they set those up, and in Dan, they practiced idolatry to these idols with these men functioning as priests, and they continued to do so until they were taken captive. 722 BC, that the 10 northern tribes were taken captive. And this is prior to David, so we're before 1000 BC, so they continue doing this for what do we have, 300 to 400 years perhaps in here at this time? Because David's about 1000 and they go into captivity 722. So somewhere 300 to 400 years. But tells you from the get-go, these guys have been practicing idolatry in the land all this time. I missed that even. I picked that up today when I was reading back. I didn't even catch a note on that when I went through this the first time, and I'm not for sure why. And they set them up for themselves, Micah's graven image, which he made all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh. See, it's at Shiloh, but instead of going to Shiloh, which actually isn't even that far away from where they're at, they're going over here to worship these idols. Okay. Any questions at this? Yes.
Just something. When we were talking about these things that they picked up, kind of like for Lucky Charms or whatever, and didn't with the Ark, though, they did that for Jericho. They had to have the Ark and go around the walls of Jericho.
Because God had told them to do that.
Right. But precisely. So what I'm saying is that's one instance where the Ark was involved in that
right.
conquest, where they had to do that.
Right.
But no other time.
But no other time, no. Because the Ark was not to be treated as a weapon of war. That's not the way it was supposed to be operated.
So I wonder why was it then, you know, God allowed it to be that way that time, but yet now from then on, no other times.
I don't know. I can't answer that.
So they look back at that time, you know, they know the stories about Joshua and Jericho and the Ark and all that.
And they may have it. What happens is it perhaps is a demonstration of the danger of not having instruction or word from God on a matter, and drawing an assumption, a conclusion. Well, this happened then, so I assume I should do it this way this time, without God having said you're going to do it this way this time. But again, that's a little bit of a conjecture, since we don't have a chapter and verse that says that. Now we move into icky story number two. Icky story number one involves idolatry and the establishment of idolatry. Very well defined. And remember, this is going on the whole time that the ark is at Shiloh, tabernacle's at Shiloh. But it's also going on, this idolatry is going on through most of the history of Judah. So now we come to the second icky story. And this is the really icky one as far as my wife's concerned, and I would have to agree. I can't disagree with her. But in chapter 19, in verse 1, now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel. Again, emphasizes third time in these sections that we've been reminded there's no king in Israel. That there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim. Remember, that's north of Benjamin, so it's north of Judah. Who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. A concubine is, and I finally... almost all the old materials always said that a concubine was a secondary wife, but more recent research into the idea indicates that a concubine was actually a purchased wife. It was a slave that you took and then didn't just treat her just strictly as a slave, but then she became a wife. But because she's a slave, she did not have some of the freedoms that a wife married under normal circumstances did. She was never in any way ever allowed to go free, and God told them that under the law. He says if you have a woman, you take her as a slave and you humble her. These are things you can't do. You could never give her a written of divorce. You could do that if you under law because of the hardness of your heart, as Jesus says. If you took a woman under normal circumstances to marry, you could give her a writing of divorce, but you couldn't do that with a concubine. Okay, because they were somebody that you had purchased as a slave and you had humbled them. That's the way he looked at this. So that's what he has. Somebody that's purchased, it's a secondary wife. Normally, if you have a concubine, it's an indication that you already have another wife. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. And then her husband rose, went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So he goes, there's another guy, another person with him. And so she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad. And there's an interchange that goes on. Now, what's the problem right there? There is a problem with regard to this.
You're not supposed to take her back.
Okay. If she has gone off in harlotry, you weren't supposed to do this. Flip over to Leviticus for a minute, in chapter 21. Luke 21 and verse 7. These are Leviticus.
Yeah.
What did I just say?
Luke.
Oh, Leviticus. They both start with L. Leviticus 21. And in Leviticus 21, you are dealing with verse 1 says, then the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests. So these are instructions concerning the priests. If you go down to verse 7. It says, talking about the priest, they shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband, for he is holy to God.
That's for the priest, though.
That's for the priest. And what is this man? He's a Levite.
Okay.
And he has what? He has a concubine. That's okay. But he has a concubine now that's become a harlot. He shouldn't have pursued her. He shouldn't have continued to take her as his wife. It also has the same thing in verse 9. Also, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry, she profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. This woman obviously is not, if you go back over there to Judges, she's not his daughter. She's been his wife, his concubine. But she's profaned herself with harlotry. It would be a safe thing to say. Well, let's put it this way. If you committed adultery, she should have died. Okay, she should have died. And harlotry certainly is a form of adultery, isn't it? Because you're cheating on your husband in that regard. So, but he goes after her anyway. So he's not obeying the law. And here he's a Levite, and he's not obeying the law. But then the last guy that was a Levite wasn't obeying the law either. Long story short, as we go through this, we end up finding that their travel delays because their father doesn't want them to leave. They head back, and when they get out, they're heading through the north country, and they go through Benjamin, which is north of Judah, on their return trip back up to Ephraim, where they're at, and they come across a man, and if you look in verse 16, then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going and where do you come from? And he said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem to Judah, to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem and Judah, but I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Nobody would put him up. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything. So he goes, we're okay. And we're camping out in the city square for the night, and we'll be on our way. We're good. But the old man said, peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square. So he took them into his house and gives the donkeys fodder. Verse 22, and while they were making merry, so in the middle of the night there, or during the night there, they've eaten and they're drinking and they're having a nice evening together, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, the word worthless fellows that you have in here, sons of Belial, just came across another guy named that today over in that David had to deal with. But they surrounded the house, they were pounding on the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house that we may have relations with him. And so they want to engage in a homosexual act with this man. Now, what happened with Lot. Now, Ben Orth sent some stuff with me that he had been doing some work on this. I think it was last spring. I think it was because he was trying to deal with somebody, and so he sent some stuff to me. And he said that these people had referred to this. He says, "I just want you to listen to this guy." So I got on YouTube and listened to this guy, and he's at a Methodist church somewhere presenting why the Bible is not anti-homosexual. And, you know, the thing is, the guy actually takes the Bible, and he went through verses and said, this verse says this, and this verse says, and he says, these are all the anti-homosexual verses. And if you got done and you had paid attention, you might be inclined to go, wow, I haven't been reading my Bible right. There's some conclusions that he drew and some about some of those passages that are inaccurate. But one of the things that he pointed out, and I do not disagree with the man on this, with regard to Lot, perhaps with the people of Benjamin, but probably not these people as much as with Lot, those men were practicing homosexuality, but were they doing it? This is the question. Were they doing it strictly because that's what they were, that they weren't, that they had no interest in women, or did they do it as a means of showing control? And it's really interesting, having talked with Tim about this, working as a chaplain, he says that's one of the things they have to patrol with, because that's the way you assert your power. If you are a man and you're in the prison, and you want to be the guy that's the top dog, you put those other people in line by humiliating them that way. Not necessarily just because it's what you like, but it's because the way you assert your authority. And interestingly enough, as I kind of was researching that, I found out that historically has been very true about gangs and powers in different places. A lot of times they used that. It was such a humiliating thing to submit a man to that oftentimes that was what they did. But I don't get that when I read this. I don't look that these Benjamites were doing this. That, by the way, does not excuse homosexual activity. Doesn't say that it was right in any of those passages. But that's what that guy was using, that argument. And part of his argument is right. I do think that is what they were doing in some situations. But there's enough other situations that is not what's going on. Okay, and Paul's very clear on that in the New Testament. But I go through all that because I do not believe, when you read this, I don't think these people here are trying to assert their power over this man that's come into their city. I think that they're homosexuals and they have an interest in this man. That's all it is. So bring him out. Anyway, it goes from there. Having said that, verse 23, and the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house. Do not commit this act of folly." And here's the part where we have to say, okay, how is this any better? It says, "Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine." Now, do you remember in Lot's day? What did Lot say? He was going to do the same thing. He was going to offer both of his daughters. Okay, all I can say with regard to this, every time my wife and I have read through this passage, and I don't know how many times we've read through the Bible together, but every time we come to this passage, my wife just gets really incensed. I'm not saying I don't, but I'm not a woman, and I think a woman would maybe take this a little bit more personally to think, I can't imagine that a man would be willing to just toss his daughter in the street to a mob of guys. What kind of dad is that? You know, and I would think that, as being a dad's had daughters, I'm thinking, I don't think very highly of them. I'm not defending his actions, and I'm not defending Lot's actions over there. What they chose to do and the way they chose to respond to this, in both cases, I would say that's not appropriate either. Okay? Whether you agree with me or not, I don't think I don't think that's a good alternative. What doing what they wanted wasn't right.
First Peter says that
I can't argue with that. I'm just saying, to me, it's not an acceptable alternative to do this kind of thing. So I'm not going to defend him for doing this. But he says, here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may... the New American Standard has the word ravish. It's the Hebrew word awa, which means to make low or humble. So humble them or make them low and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against these men. And the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her. Literally, they knew her. The NASB is translated rape, but it's simply the word yada for the sex between a man and woman. And they abused her all night. And the word for abuse is the Hebrew word meaning to glean, to act with severity. Because gleaning a field was considered severe. Taking just harvesting a field wasn't. Gleaning it was now severe because you weren't leaving anything left. Okay, isn't that what you do when you glean? You go out and clean every last bit of fruit out of it, technically. Well, that's so that they use that word for severe. In other words, they treat her with such abuse, there's just nothing left to her when they're done. Get the picture? How gruesome this is? You and I see abuse and we think that's bad. The Hebrew word is even tougher, okay, is what I'm trying to get across to you. And they did so all night long until morning, and then they let her go at the approach of dawn, and as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until daylight. And when her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of his house with her hands on the threshold. And he said, get up, let us go. I don't ask me to defend him. I do not understand what he does here. But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory. In other words, she's died, quite honestly. Most of us understand that. And sent her throughout the territory of Israel, and it came about that all who saw said, nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. So in other words, the severity of this act, and again, the whole point of this, if you think that this is horrible what goes on here, both on the part of the way the Levites responded as well as the way the men of the city acted, if you find it horrible, that's the very point of the whole story, that this was a horrible act, okay? Because it's what was happening in the land when there was no king. All of this is driving eventually to what we have in 1 Samuel where they actually... ask for a king, but there's no king. They should have been acknowledging God, but they weren't. What ends up happening then, as a result of all this, when we come into the next chapter in chapter 20, is that they...
Now, when he cut her up, though, she was already dead.
Yeah, I was saying that. Yeah, she was already dead. Yeah, he doesn't... There's no evidence that he killed her like this. Well, I don't. I presume that.
Because it says there was no answer. She was dead.
Well, doesn't mean she was dead.
She just could have been. Yeah, I presume when there was no answer from her that she was dead or about ready to die. And she probably dies laying on the donkey on the trip home from this point on.
Probably verse 5:25. They meant to kill me and they violated my concubine and she is dead.
Yeah, and
So I took hold of my concubine.
Does everybody see that in chapter 20 and verse 5?
And 6.
Yeah. So if you put this together. Now,
so
what ends up happening to kind of truncate the rest of this story is that they call the tribes out. The tribes all then come to this man's aid. They send out men from all these other tribes.
Sending a piece of a person. I don't even get that. Like, why would you do that? Why can't you just send messenger? I mean, how could you tell? Oh, this one
I think because violated. I think because this showed the severity of what was happening.
Again, shock factor.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was just trying to show you, you know, this
is story would come after the shock.
Yeah, yeah. So, I know.
It's kind of like the football thing where they showed the video and they slapped him with the 2-game suspension because he hit the wife. Now they saw the video, the shock value.
Or the people that cut off the people's heads just recently, and that's caused the public opinion to sway. I mean, you know, that viciousness is...
So what happens is they gather against Benjamin, and they come down, and if you go down to verse 13, they send some men to Benjamin. Verse 13, now then, deliver up the men, the worthless fellows of Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel. One of the things exactly what they were supposed to do, remove the wickedness from them, but the sons of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the sons of Israel. And the sons of Benjamin gathered from the cities of Gibeah to go out to battle. Verse 15 tells us that the sons of Benjamin were numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword beside the inhabitants of Gibeah, who were numbered around 700 choice men. But it tells us in verse 17, then the men of Israel besides Benjamin were numbered. There were 400,000 men who drew the sword, and we end up having a battle. And it tells us in verse 21, and the sons of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and they fell to the ground on that day, 22,000 men of Israel. But the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves, arrayed for battle, again in the place where they had arrayed themselves on the first day. The men of Benjamin come out in verse 25, and they kill 18,000. And so they're encouraged again. And so verse 43 tells us after they've actually... Let's go up to verse 35. I missed verse 35. Verse 34 says, when 10,000 choice men from all Israel came against Gibeah, the battle became fierce, but Benjamin did not know that the disaster was close to them, and the Lord struck Benjamin before Israel, so that the sons of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day, all who draw the sword. So the sons of Benjamin saw that they were defeated when the men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they relied on the men in the ambush whom they had set up against them in Gibeah. So they end up being defeated, but we end up having this warfare that takes place. Yes.
So it was going through, they were all, it was going on very throughout because they're all fighting, it seems like, Benjamites.
Okay, I'm not for sure. What's
spread? This was just a couple of guys with the two women, and there's...
Well, see, and he cuts up his concubine, sends it out to all the tribes, and so those tribes come and gather.
Yeah.
They all go up to the place where Benjamin is, and the people, all these people from Israel now say, bring out those men that did this act. We're going to put them to death. Benjamin won't comply, so they array themselves in battle. And Benjamin comes out and kills a bunch of the people. And what's going on? So they get their courage up again. Benjamin comes out again and kills a bunch of the Israelites. And so finally the Israelites actually have to turn to God, one of the things that they should have done in the first place. And when they actually turn to the Lord, and we should look at that. Verse 26, then all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept, and thus they remained there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. They offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And they should have done that even before they went to Benjamin in the first place. But they just, out of this sense of indignation for what had happened, they just go off to war. We're going to avenge. Again, a good lesson, I think, for us, of being cautious, because Paul tells us that in Romans 12. It is not your job to avenge yourself. No, God was going to let these people avenge themselves, but he wanted them to come to him about it, not just to immediately say, well, this is an easy thing to figure out. We're just going to avenge ourselves. God didn't want him to do it that way. Okay, God wanted him to do it a proper way. You and I today, we're on the other side. We're not supposed to be ones that are seeking vengeance. We're supposed to just leave that in God's hands. But that's Romans 12. So as a result, when this is all done, we've had this civil war. These people in Israel are very broke up about this. And what ends up happening is... let me find my next verse. I've got to get my... Okay, chapter 21, verse 1. It says, now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin in marriage. So verse 7, people of Benjamin say, well, what shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord, do not give them any of our daughters in marriage. So after what happened with Benjamin, because of the civil war, because they defended these men, these worthless fellows, now the rest of the tribes will say, well, your daughters can't marry any of ours. Well, what problem does that create? Pretty soon it's just intermarriage, because you've got this tribe. Granted, it's fairly large, but it's not going to take very long. When you're having probably in every generation, you're having 5 to 10 kids in every generation, it doesn't take very long that pretty soon that generation's so big that you've got all these people intermarrying other people. As a result, you got a problem. And so they knew that for their sake, they needed to be able to marry others. So this is what happens. How many of you have read this story? Because to me, this is always an interesting story. Verse 8, and they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah to deal with this? I'm going to jump on down here into the context, and I'm going to show you what they do. Beginning in verse 18, we cannot give them wives of our daughters, for the sons of Israel had sworn, saying, cursed is he who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they said, behold, there is a feast of the Lord from year to year in Shiloh. And there were feasts that God designated. So these were one of God designated feasts, okay, which is on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes from Bethel to Shechem, and on the south, verse 19, and on the south side of Labona. And they commanded the sons of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And behold, if the daughters of Shiloh come out to take part in the dances, then you shall come out of the vineyards, and each of you shall catch his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. So basically what they're saying, well, nobody's going to give you a wife, but if they come down there for the feast and the daughters go out to dance, you run out of the vineyards and you grab yourself a wife. Snatch your wife, take her home. Verse 22, and it shall come about when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us that we shall say to them, well, give them to us voluntarily, because we did not take for each man from Benjamin a wife in battle. So, in other words, they didn't go and steal the Benjamite wives, which they could have done. Nor did you for them, else you would now be guilty. And the sons of Benjamin did so and took wives according to their number from those who danced, whom they carried away, and they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the cities and lived in them. And the sons of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. Each one of them went out from there to his inheritance. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So we have these two really horrible tales that kind of tell you what happens, and then even one of those tales gives rise to a civil war, which then gives rise to this interesting situation about how do you get a wife? Well, guys, you're just going to run out of the orchard and you're going to grab the wives from the girls that are dancing, which we'd say, boy, what a way to get a wife. I just...
got to be careful when you dance in the vineyards.
Yeah, I guess so. But again, the point of all of these things in here, and it's been repeated for us 5 times in this section, was that these things were being done at a time when there was no king. And twice it's been told in this section that this happens during a time when every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. What were they supposed to have been doing? They were supposed to have been going to the priest and having the priests teach them the law and learning the law and then enforcing the law. But they're not doing that. And these passages right here are perfect examples of the fact that these people are just for themselves trying to figure out what we should do. Even the priests and even Israel, when they come up against to avenge these two women, or this woman and this one woman, the concubine in particular, but to wreak vengeance on what these men wanted to do in Benjamin, and they come up to that, even they were supposed to do what? Not just rush to vengeance, but to go to the Lord. And that's the whole point. They're not going to the Lord to seek for information. And so these two really are illustrative. They're real events, but they're illustrative of what's been happening throughout the history of the judges. When it tells you that these people pursued other gods and that they were doing evil things, We look at that and go, okay, they were bound down to idols. That's bad. But you know, no, this is what it looked like. This is the kind of thing that happened in it. I mean, you and I wouldn't say that. They're bound down to other gods. You know, as a kid, I would have thought, well, that's bad. But, you know, it's just a little idol, you know. And, well, that's a horrible thing. You shouldn't do that. But it just shows you. See, there's a lot of things connected with that.
It also shows a stark contrast because women weren't as property back then. And the contrast in the New Testament to being no male or female in Christ.
That's right.
The equality that there is in Christ. It's a stark contrast.
Okay. Next week we will come back and we've got one more study in this time of the Judges, and it's going to be with the book of Ruth. And Ruth will be a stark contrast to everything else. When everybody else is doing what's... I give you the book of Ruth in a nutshell. When everybody else is doing what's right in their own eyes, Boaz did what was right according to the law. And that's the book of Ruth. I guess we don't even have to go through it now, but we'll hit some things with Ruth next week. So, any other questions or comments? If you hadn't been familiar with that, now you know the icky story. That's why I call it that. And the icky is not a probably strong enough term. But yes, there are, but that's just... So. Okay, well, let's have a word of prayer then. Our Father, we are thankful that you are a faithful God and that you are a righteous God. And we realize that it is not man's nature to be righteous. The only way that we have any kind of righteous, even we as New Testament believers, is when we are properly relating to you, when we are following the Spirit's lead. We actually can not only be righteous at your right hand, which you count us to be, but we can be righteous in our practice. And we realize as we look at these people that when people act on their own, when people try to decide for themselves what they ought to do, it does not result in righteousness. And that's as true for us today as it was for them. Help us, Lord, to be those that would not do what appears right in our eyes, but doing that which you have indicated in your word for us as New Testament believers is appropriate. And we would thank you for it then. Amen.